Well, I'm just saying, you're handsome, sophisticated, a gentleman, a scholar. You're great at almost everything I've heard you've applied yourself to.
Wow, thank you, Jesse.
Jan, no, we have a guest with us, if you'd please.
Oh, wow.
I didn't think he was talking about me either. I was like, who is this guy?
No, Johnny Pack, I'm not only excited to have you here, I also mean all the things I just said. This podcast I'm going to listen to after we're done recording it, because I'm just interested to hear your opinions on games and design and what you think about the title that we're covering today. I really don't know if I have not talked to you about this one at all. I don't know if you like it, if you love it, if you're mixed on it, if you think it's a poor example of game design in general. I'm very intrigued.
Well, I think the game. I mean, no spoilers since we haven't said what it is
yet.
But
you're gonna have to cut that out.
Do I? Okay, so what I'm thinking I should do is probably welcome to Played It Once, a podcast about games we've only played once. The reality is that most board games only make it to the table one time, and first impressions matter. So we made a podcast about ours. I'm your host, Jam Vegas, and with me is a very annoying Jesse Anderson and the star of today's show, Mr. Johnny Pack.
I mean,
how you doing, guys?
I'm not as annoying as that intro, but that's all right.
How was my intro annoying,
sir? That was pretty good, man. That's selling it.
Thank you, Johnny. See, Jesse, this is what you do. You support your co-host. You don't berate them.
Could you take a moment to introduce who our guest is?
Oh, you mean
it might be helpful.
You mean the designer of Coloma, Fistful of Meeples, Lions of Lydia, Hangtown, also co-designer of Endless Winter and Merchant's Cove? Maybe that person, Mr. Johnny Pack? Is that who?
It's like
he knows
my games. I mean, you're saying those off faster than I can read them off BGG, so.
Hey, it's called prep, and also I'm a fan of you, Johnny. So
appreciate it.
So, Johnny, give us a little bit more context as to your particular focus on games, because you do have a bit of a style in particular that you go to, and you also you have a love for your hometown where a lot of these games are also based off.
Yeah, so a few of them that got signed and released all in 2019 were three Western themed games, and they do have roots in my local surroundings. So there's the Gold Rushy sort of thing, and Coloma is an actual Gold Rush town, the one that actually started the California Gold Rush, of which 49ers and things like that are later named after. And Fistful of Meeples is a little more whimsical and all that. So right away, I got a little bit typecast as the Western designer, which was fun. And I was also wearing, like, you know, a big corduroy cowboy hat to certain conventions, and
you do like the style.
I like goofy vintage stuff, so I mean I'm all about, like, the 70s, you know, pearl snaps, Western shirts and all that sort of thing. And so it was easy to just throw on some of that stuff and do a curly mustache. And so, yeah, between that and then the weird situation where my leather shoes got soaked going to Gen Con, I end up wearing Crocs the whole convention. I got known as the Cowboy in Crocs, and I haven't lived that one down yet. So,
and from the last time that we spoke, you have a core tenet in terms of your design, and it's streamlining games, making sure that the game is as efficient and lean as possible so that people can just focus on the fun,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, something I tried to do. I mean, I think there's that make things as simple as possible, but no simpler. I think there is a line where you can streamline something down to the point where it's too streamlined. Like, if you say the card is the money, and the card is also the thing that you're buying, and the card is also all this other stuff. And as much as people like multi-use cards, sometimes having something as a unique component will actually reduce the cognitive load of trying to remember the multifaceted nature of a given thing.
Well, I'm scrapping that game design that has 17 uses for a single card.
I mean, it could be done, and it could be brilliant. It's just so sometimes less is more, and sometimes separating things out instead of having them layered on top of each other conceptually or visually is also a process of streamlining, even though it is taking up more materials, bigger footprint, bigger visual field, that sort of thing. So it's I think there's a couple different ways to approach it.
So outside of all the games that Jan just listed, or including those if you want, in your design philosophy and the way you approach everything, if there was one thing you wanted the audience to know about who Johnny Pack is, what should they be aware of?
A total badass.
Well, am I close? I don't know if it's about me or about my game. So one thing that I like about
both
game design is that the designer is a little bit removed from the idea. It's like being involved in music and things like that. You have to worry if, you know, you look cool on stage, and if you're, you know, when you get gray and grizzly like me, if you're still going to look cool on stage, or if you ever looked cool on stage. It's nice to not have those sorts of concerns and just know that people are generally just going to judge the game on its own merits and what it's brought to their life on their table with their friends, their family. And to not really feel like I'm a ghost in the room sitting there and thinking, oh, he put this in here and he put that in there. Praise him. It's more about their experience, what they do with those things to create, you know, the situation that you hope that people get a moment of joy and a certain type of intimacy with other human beings in the same room.
If you think that's going to keep Jan and I from fanboying over you when we see you next, you're wrong.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I like, you know, I'm an eccentric person with an unusual background. So it's like, I'm becoming more comfortable with the idea that I show up as the cowboy in Crocs or whatever I show up as, and that I'm not always going to mind my P's and Q's, or as much as, say, on Twitter, people are arguing whether or not you should say mechanism or mechanic. And I'm sitting here just going like, they're synonyms. It doesn't matter. You can call a drop pile mystery meat for all you care, as long as it's in context. So
I wish people could just see a snippet of your background right now, because that to me is the pure definition, visual representation of eccentric. That looks just, there's so much happening, but it all looks so cool.
Yeah, I've got a giant oil painting behind me. I've got vintage stuffed animals. I've got a fiber optic flower that, you know, changes colors. So, you know, feel like you're on drugs if you look at it too long, and Christmas lights and,
dude,
you know,
oh my God. It's almost like a Salvador Dali painting to a certain degree.
What if you look at it too long while you're on drugs?
It doesn't seem like it's changing. That's the weird thing. You're like, whoa, it's staying still, man. And you're like, it has this reverse effect. So,
so speaking of a bunch of things happening, today's game is called Russian Railroads. It's actually quite well timed, because there's a new big box edition of this game coming out,
which is surprising, because when I first was introduced to this game by one of my friends, he said, yes, run to eBay and purchase a copy immediately if you want one, because there'd never be another printing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Z-Man, who's the American localization partner for Hansam Gluck, who's the original publisher of it, has kind of a reputation for not reprinting great games sometimes. And then sometimes they'll still stay in print longer in the German catalog. And then sometimes you get it where they're kind of offset a little bit, where, for instance, the Stefan Feld game that was everybody's really wanted, they're hoping to see another version come out from Z-Man again, but instead it ended up getting re-implemented by Queen recently. So we're never really sure if it's like, are we going to see that game again through the same channel in the same form, or is it going to get picked up by another publisher and reskinned and re-implemented with maybe different theme and mechanics? In this case, appears that it's called Ultimate Railroads in the new version, because Russian Railroads was the base game. And then if you got the expansion, which was also really hard to get, was German Railroads. And then there's American Railroads. And then there's a new one, Asian Railroads, which I don't know much about. All being thrown into the same big box. And so I think it makes sense to not call it Russian Railroads / German Railroads /... and just kind of go like, this is all the railroads you need in this.
I don't know. That sounds pretty catchy to me.
It's a lot of different countries. So, you know, it is a very Euro game. And for a train game, it doesn't have a lot of the things that you would associate with, like, there's not a giant map and you're not placing little pieces of track and connecting the dots from this spot and the other spot. It's not pick up and deliver. There's a lot of things it's not doing. And so, even for a, you know, I don't really play 18XX games and things like that. For a non-trained gamer, we could just say that mechanically, it just scratches a lot of itches in whatever it is. So I think it could have been re-implemented into something else, but it didn't. But I'm happy that, you know, it is what it is. I'm just happy people get to play it, because it's really fun.
This is, just like you're saying, a really interesting genre of game. I mean, it is really, truly a Euro. It is a worker placement. It is a math puzzle, and it is a math puzzle that introduces itself as a train game. And I have seen some people that have been, you know, moderately disappointed that there wasn't a big, large map or a pick up and deliver mechanic or a stock market necessarily that controls the flow of inventory that's moving in and out of these railroad stations. Right. Jan, let's go ahead and go over for the audience a little bit about what this game is and how it operates on the table so that we can dig into our personal experiences with it.
Oh, yeah. And for this, I'm just going to leave it up to Johnny because it sounds like he's played it just once very well, I think.
Oh,
was
yeah.
The
we
case.
Didn't even clarify. All of us have only played this game once, right?
Right. So the idea is I played it once by itself. Russian Railroads. I played German Railroads, which is Russian Railroads with that just once. I played American Railroads just once. So I've played each of the expansions along with the core game just once. The things that are changed,
everything once,
which
that's
is
fair.
Different, is the central board stays the same for the most part in these games, but the player boards are large and the routes and the things that you can do on them are moderately different from each other. You can tell there's a difference and there's more stuff or different stuff you can do on those boards. And so my first exposure to it was years ago, and then I'd played American Rails sometime in 2020, and then just months ago I played German Railroads. So it's a little bit fresh in my head still.
On a player's turn, they're going to be deciding between a variety of different options. First off is going to be the classic worker placement zones and regions on that center board that you mentioned. You're going to have a lot of locations that are going to be pushing up different elements of your railroad track or influencing things on your personal board by adding engineers, which are additional worker placement zones, to establishing factories, creating pathways, or slowly progressing your own quality of railroad track from one region to another. These are going to be represented in different, different railways, each with different locations and sections that you'll be sliding these cubes up as you play the game. The real crux or core mechanic of the game is that as you move farther and farther down the quality of your railroad track, as you get different cubes farther down your railroad lines, you're going to be unlocking a variety of things, from additional scoring opportunities and abilities to new railway pieces, which are different colored cubes, to more workers that you can utilize. You're going to be chaining abilities and activations from one region to another. The farther you get down, the higher you'll score, the more you will unlock, and the more complex that puzzle will become. But there's a crux. As you unlock different types of railway systems, different colored cubes, those cubes start bumping up into and against each other. Mm-hmm. You can never move one past your farthest, which is going to be the black cube. That's going to dictate sort of a limiting factor or the degree to which you can start building and generating this engine. It really feels like you're an operating station or a little engine that's trying to solve this complex puzzle. Along with that central board that's going to give you control of everything happening on your player board, the place where you're doing your worker placement and your action selection, that's also going to be limited. And in classic Euro form, there's going to be a lot of locations you'd love to go to, and depending on your turn order and how quickly you get to them, they're going to be taken. This game really is, it's at its heart, a Euro and a math puzzle. With a ton of scoring opportunity. I know for myself, well, before I get to what I think, is there any main mechanics I've overlooked there in terms of how people are taking their turns and what they're doing across the course
of
the game?
That was really good. I think there's a couple little things.
I tried really hard.
There's little train tiles that you put on the left of these tracks, and they have a number value, and they sum up in some cases that number value, and that is how far your track, let's say, is powered. So even if you pushed all those cubes all the way down the track further and further, they're considered not validated in a sense until you've got numbers that reach that thing. So if I've got my black cube all the way down to the seventh space, but I don't have a strength of seven to the left to validate that, certain things won't unlock. So it's like another layer to that puzzle, how you're doing that. And so there's that layer, and then the other layer is that there's a secondary track down at the bottom of these factory technologies, and there's like a little daisy chain that you're creating, and those are built off the backside of the things that power the other train. So you got these double-sided tokens that you're acquiring from the market, and you're choosing, do I want to power up to get more bigger numbers, or do I want to drop that to my little tableau below, which will create this little path from which then I can move this little factory tracker along to unlock even crazier bonuses. And so it's a little bit nebulous, but all those things are happening at once. in a surprisingly fast and elegant way. I would still say it's not purposely hard to solve, I guess, or not solve, but hard to utilize. All these things are easy to do.
And so, Johnny, if we were to summarize the main mechanics of this game, would be worker placement and tableau building and endgame scoring? Would those be like the three general main
conceits
for this one?
You're not really tableau building.
A little bit. I mean, that it's sort of, but it's mostly keeping those, pushing those tracks up. I know it sounds kind of boring, but you're validating, pushing tracks, but it's almost like unlocking combos.
It kind of feels like Ganshan Clever.
Mm-hmm. Right, because
a sequencing of numbers in pairs that just start unlocking and popping other abilities.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, it definitely has that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so with that, I'm really curious as to what exactly about this game, Johnny, do you think is unique about it? Right? Why did people seek this out so feverishly? How has design evolved? Have you found a game that does something similar to Ultimate Railroads or Russian Railroads in the time since it came out? And if it hasn't, what exactly are people not really discovering with this one yet?
There's a few things. I'm going to jump around to that answer. So that same author later came out with a game that's called First Class by the same publisher. And it's also out of print now, a little bit easier to get than Russian Railroads, which is effectively a card game sort of version of a similar thing where you're building tracks of trains and all this. It's again a train game that doesn't feel exactly like a train game, and you're trying to lay out these cards to build the tracks. Then you need to move a little conductor down the track to effectively validate those numbers that is similar to the other ones. There's a lot of parallels between the two games, and it also has that combo-tastic thing going on where you do something to unlock something else, which unlocks something else, and then you can do these crazy powerful, feels like they're broken sort of moves, and then the next player does something equally as crazy and powerful, and in the end it kind of shakes out that you didn't completely diverge as far as points go in the end somehow magically. So I think those are, they're kind of like a neat second helping. Like, I feel like if you like one, you're probably going to like the other one. You might have a little bit of a favorite of one or the other. It tends to be that Russian Railroad seems to be a little bit more popular than First Class for whatever reason. I think First Class, maybe it's because it's a card game that plays like a board game that's also a train game that's not really a train game. Might be pushing it for people. I'm not sure, but it's a fantastic game as well. And the toss up of like, which one do you bring, you know, at the end of the earth with you? It's like, I don't know. But when I was actually asked that question on Five Games for Doomsday, I actually chose First Class as one that I would bring with me because it naturally has all these little modules that you build in to do some different stuff. And it plays out in some slightly different ways where maybe if I could bring Ultimate Railroads with all the stuff bundled in, maybe I would have picked that actually. But so those are similar
and
in a way.
And that's a question that I want to ask later.
Which ones do you bring to the end of the earth? So those are two things. And one thing that I think is really neat about both of those games, and I think there's a note in both the rule books about it, is the freedom of which you're allowed on your turn to perform a variety of bonuses and actions. Like, sure, you need to place a worker and do the worker thing, but there's some additional stuff you can do where that might be unlocking something. And it's not like a set order. It's like, once you do this, you have to go down to Appendix A and score A before B and B before C and do this thing. And there's this weird kind of like, if I twist this and do it in this weird order, you can squeeze out a different result than if you twist it in a different order. And that might be across a couple turns or within the same turn. But that freedom is fascinating. And I feel like that's also in First Class, that there's a bunch of different ways you can do things. And it's not always true. It's like there's a best way that's going to net you more points than the other way. It might net you more utility in one way or a different domain. And the kind of no rules Wild West part of that makes a lot of sense. And I think it gives a certain responsibility to player. It's like, look, you're smart enough to sort this out. Like, go in there and have fun. Here's a bunch of elements. Make something and get creative with this. And you almost feel a little bit of
get
creative
out there
identity
and play,
with
kids.
It.
So it's almost like, so basically, what I'm not sure if this is a mechanic, more of a descriptor. So this is almost like a sandbox mathematical euro.
A little bit.
Based on that,
yeah,
on that description,
there's a certain
right?
sandbox element to it. As far as the procedures go, it's not you know, scripted to a certain amount of things. And some games have it. It's like every turn you do one very simple thing that has, you know, great consequences, which is nice and elegant. And then other ones will have big combos that you can do, but there's like phases. It's like, you know, first you have to play your cards and you activate the white ones on this one. And then you have a buy phase and you can buy twice and those go into your discard. You know, it goes through this procedural thing. And this just has a loose feel where if you want to do something weird in a weird order because it works for you, you could probably shake it out and make it work. And it's, again, really fascinating because a lot of the things, another thing I'd notice is the scoring track. You're going to see big numbers in this game. It's going to end with scores 250, 300, 350, way beyond that. So big scoring. And so you see like little numbers, like I get 25 points for doing, getting this weird bonus tile and putting on this track and putting the little thing on there to get the thing on the thing. And it's going to give me this crazy amount of points. And you go like 25 points. I mean, that's a lot in a lot of Euro games. It's like, we can maybe have this heuristic that 100 points is a lot in a lot of Euro games. And you think of 25 points as being significant. It is in this game, but it's not going to win you the game. You'll have all sorts of these moments where you do these crazy big number scoring moves and you're just like, whoa, how can, you know, and your piece goes way up ahead and you're just like, that's amazing. I'm 40 points ahead of you. And then you do something and you get 45 points and we're back into that, you know, small delta margin. But I think just that sensation of seeing things explode like that is just so much fun. I think people are getting like a big dopamine hit out of it beyond the incremental sort of like penny pinching sometimes you'll see in a very, very tight Euro game. I feel like these are very loose Euro games, which I think is the big appeal for me about it.
Speaking exactly of that, feeling of constantly pushing and evolving and growing, I remember that the adrenaline that you get from successfully completing certain tracks feels fantastic. But also, if you're having a little bit of difficulty parsing this very freeform nature, you could get stuck just like those rails get stuck as you start moving upwards, right? Depending, like in this game, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Johnny, because I have only played this game once,
well, and it was a few years ago as well.
Yes, also that. But first player in this game and player order is so crucial because since everything is so freeform, as you said, you won't get to do one of the most pivotal things for your turn if you don't prioritize that, right? So if you don't have a good handle on that type of strategy and that type of thinking, you can get really, really left behind on the rails here.
Well, and it really depends on what you're trying to do, Jan, because I know in our first experience of this game, first player usually was utilized going after the additional workers, which then could be used to do bonus actions and things throughout the course.
Yep.
However, there's a lot of other locations that have a lot of value to them. It just really depends on what stage in your strategy you are. And there's even a benefit to being lower down on that player order and not claiming first player because you get some little victory points. You get a little bit of, you know, stuff back and you're not pressured to necessarily have to go to what seems like it's the best. I think in this game, there is a ton of high emotions on the top and bottom of the scale, which is one of the things that I like the most about my experience with Russian Railroad so far. There is a lot of it feels really good when you connect a series of events or score a ton of points or get that perfect math puzzle set up so that every worker has successfully pushed one of your tracks up the railroad and it times out perfectly and somehow you got the sequence right. But
it's a feedback loop.
More often than not, I find that this has probably some of the deepest and darkest moments in any Euro game that I've played, which I find really, really entertaining because the board state is this pressure mechanic and it is always stopping you constantly, whether it's a player taking a worker placement zone that you need and there's not enough of them that do exactly what you need. And maybe you missed out on that one additional movement value that was going to be the key to your success, or it's your own personal board and your own personal strategy. Which just hasn't chained or unlocked enough things to allow you to do what you need. Or, God forbid, you take an action that makes you waste two or three additional movement because you haven't pushed something far enough up the track. The crunch in this game feels, and I've heard people say that this isn't a very thematic game.
Right.
And everyone that listens to this knows that I'm a very thematic player. And I would venture to disagree with that concept, that this is just math, or this is just a puzzle, or this is just a Euro or worker placement game. For me, that struggle of getting an engine, getting a sequence up and running, the, you know, the railroads progressing and moving down the line, I can visualize. And while I was playing, I was imagining the feeling of these workers, right? Loading carts full of different types of metal and steel and moving down the railroad track and getting stuck at a bend or a crux or a place that hadn't been developed yet. It may not be a story-driven game. It may just be a Euro puzzle. But to me, everything seemed to line up with the idea of what it would be like to construct and operate and exist in a Russian railroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think thematically, it's tied in. There's no arbitrary thing that's just like, what is this thing really? And I think maybe that stems from that designer's background in the 18XX games, because he's made very few like straight Euro games. He's got a giant BGG catalog of all these 18XX games with his co-designer Lonnie. I can't remember his last name, but so I think there's that background of just borrowing that vocabulary and context. It was very easy for them to just drop into this game and see kind of what makes sense. So yeah, I think there's that. And I think circling back to the worker placement part of it, there's a few little things that I think are unique about it. And one of them is that some of the worker placement spots require multiple workers. So it might take two workers to go there. So you have a lot of workers in this game. It's and then you get more as you unlock tracks and things. But then some of these places require that you actually spend more workers. And so you're kind of caught in between sometimes where, do I want to do this weaker version of an action that requires one worker, or do I put two workers and do a better version of this thing? And what do I think you want? Because maybe I'm happy with either of those versions.
That's half the game.
And there's that. And then he does a weird thing in both this and First Class, is money doesn't really work like money in either of these games. As soon as you realize the coins aren't doing things that coins do, coins in this are proxy workers.
Very good point.
And so it's like you can spend a coin to be a worker at any of these spots. And some of the worker placement spots actually require only a coin, and you can't use a normal meeple there. And so, and then similar in First Class, there's coins that you get and you never spend them to buy anything. You spend them to take extra actions and unlock things and push conductors around, do all these other actions. So they're effectively bonus actions, or in this case, bonus workers. And so your existing pool of workers can exist from the ones that you have, the ones that you unlock. If you have a means of getting a bunch of coins, you just go, those are more workers. And then there's a worker placement spot in the 3-4 player game that has these two, I think, turquoise workers that you can put one of your workers and then get back two more workers. So you can take a stronger turn later, knowing that you'll probably give a chance for other players to get first dibs on the next go round of spaces. And then, as you kind of mentioned, the ones that go to claim player order then get reallocated from their player order spots back into the board later, assuming that there's still some dregs to find spaces for. And not to mention that there's some modular worker placement spots that kind of come out in this river queue, and one of them becomes available for the players. The other one you can buy, and it goes into a player's tableau, of which they can personally use for the rest of the game by placing a worker there as opposed to out on the board. So the order which those comes out and who buys them, if they get bought, is the timer of the game. It also creates a little bit of that sense of maybe there is some engine building, that I've got a worker placement spot that does something for me that's different, along with those little factories and unlocks I've got. Is we will very quickly diverge in how we're playing the game and what's available to you on your board based on the path dependency of what you've already put into it early game as it arrives to the late game.
And Johnny, I guess like one of the main questions mechanically that I wanted to ask for before we get into the titular question of the show is, how exactly do you do what this game does, which is create that feedback loop that is so rewarding, so enriching, so euphoric, but inside of a sandbox title? Like, how exactly do you tie point C with point A and then make that point A interface with point Z? And just like, I can't imagine the web of interconnections that this has. Like, how exactly did they do this?
Well, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a great case study just to look at. I'm working on a project right now, and I literally just brought the game out and just laid out all the tiles in their value order on the floor. And it's just like, how did they assign the difference between these things? And were they rounding up small numbers and lumping them? And where's the fractions in these things? Because sometimes it's like, for instance, a simple example is if you place one worker and you get, say, one silver rail pushed along. And if you place two workers and you get three silver rails pushed along, and assuming that you've got room to place those silver rails and you have silver rails to push along, that sort of thing, which of those, what is the actual value of a rail and the worker as the input to that versus two workers for three, with the assumption that you've got the margin to actually push those things along? And is the actual spreadsheet saying that there's a balance due between those things? And so is one actually better or worse than the other one? Or does it really come down to market dynamics, where it depends is the real answer, and it depends on your board state, and it depends on everybody else's board state, and what's at stake when those things get pushed versus the opportunity cost of other things? So that in itself is a very nebulous question, but there's some indications with this game and some other games that sometimes, because we have to work with small numbers and whole numbers, that if you can't hide something easily, like getting three for two, that's an easy way to hide a fraction. Sometimes things get rounded into other things. They get rounded up, they get rounded down a little bit. And a crunchy player can sometimes see that. And I don't know if that's a good thing, but I think the instinctual player should just be able to go, if we're playing Quaxic Wedlinburg and this, you know, root costs 17 and this other little ingredient costs 16, am I really going to feel that $1 difference in its utility, given we don't know when it's going to come out in this queue and how it's going to operate with everything that comes before, during, and after it, with all the other contingencies of this thing? Is that $1 difference going to matter? Could those costs have been inverted in the design process from 16 to 17, 17 to 16? I would probably argue that they probably could have been inverted without any real life consequences. However, if one of them has the emotional appeal that this seems slightly better than the other one or is more scarce, yeah, sure, let's assign that one the higher value and just call it a day and not get hung up on the fraction, this minuscule fraction that we probably won't have the humans in the universe long enough to actually see enough trials to actually shake out whether that thing actually is pivotal once you control for everything else in the experiment.
And, wow. And this is
Jesse,
where
you still sure we can design games?
I was literally just going to say, this is where I realized I'd never design a Euro game.
Wow. I had no idea that's the type of brain
thinking.
That was
such a cool answer, though.
Wow. Okay. So I think the answer is pretty clear, at least for most people in the podcast already. And I think it's time for that big, big, important question.
I'm going to follow up on that important question, too, just for the record, Jim. But go ahead with it.
Oh, interesting. Did you enjoy it? And would you play it again?
Yes, 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 definitely. It's something. I'm one of those people. I bought it when it came out. I bought the expansions when they came out, so I didn't pay crazy prices for it.
Lucky you. Good eye.
And I'm probably still going to buy
$600 on that right now.
Yeah, I might actually have a friend that I'm going to turn it over to, who's been jonesing for it for years. So, and I'm probably going to get the ultimate box set once it comes out, assuming that it's all, you know, not riddled with any issues or anything like that.
So that was the secondary question I was going to ask. Okay. Whether or not you own it or do own it or have owned it, are you personally getting the Ultimate Edition, and would you recommend to our audience, if this sounds like the type of game that they would like, meaning, you know, a sandbox, you know, not really a sandboxy, but a mathematical puzzle and a really, really solid feel good and feel bad Euro style game, would you recommend that people pick this up?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. I actually just watched the new Dice Tower top 10 worker placement games of Z, Sarah, and Tom, and then they also had the People's Choice, and you know, this would have, if I was on that panel, I would have put this way, way up there, like way up towards the top. So I think it's that good. So I think it needs to get back into circulation, not just be this grail game. I think some people are going to realize, oh, I've been looking at buying this for $200 for the last 5 years, or whatever else. And they're going to get it and be like, this is it. It's just a, you know, dry Euro. And they might have
the expectation
too high. It might be a little bit. So I think if you come at it with some sort of expectation of a reasonable of what's actually in that box and why it is what it is, you'll come away with a really good experience. And I would also point out that not all games are good with expansions. I've designed many expansions, and I'd hoped that they're good, but good expansions are probably more rare than good games. And so Russian Railroads and the German Railroads, and these, it's just one of those things. As soon as people start talking about it, they go, Russian Railroads is good. It's even better with German Railroads or American Railroads.
Yeah, but you can't get a hold of them, so I don't even want to hear that.
But they're going to be in the box set, so that's that other thing. So it's like, you don't have to be like, hey, go pay a bunch for the base game and then hope to make it good if you can ever find...
It's all in there.
So you can get straight to the good stuff and be like, let's unbox it and play German Railroads like out the gate and just, you know, feel it, you know, full hard on. Or you can work your way through, just kind of like I did. You know, I got the base game, then German came out, and then American Railroads came out, which I picked up on the BGG store. It was just like a, you know, kind of came cello wrapped in a little packet. It was just like basically a board. So the German one is more substantial, where it comes with a bunch of new tokens and other things like that. And it's got some modules. There's like a coal module, and you get to use coals as an auxiliary sort of resource to do a bunch of other crazy stuff. But yeah.
I cannot wait for the end of the year when this comes out and I can have it in my shelf and then be all cocky, like, I have Russian Railroads.
I already have it on my shelf, which probably answers the question.
Yeah, I dislike you.
Well, it's because after that first play experience, this is one of the few games that I have sought out after one play and only one play. And it was because of what we've talked about. It was because of how rewarding and crunchy and just good it felt on the table. I like that dynamic of people being in your way and resources being in your way and the puzzle itself being in your way. And I don't find that as often with Euro games. And I don't find that as often with new Euro games. Russian Railroads felt and still feels like one of the best little puzzles that I've played. And when I compared it to Gonshan Clever, it was because I was thinking back for this show on what it felt like to me. And it felt like that. It had the same degree of reward and put your hand to your forehead when you miss something and steal a die from another player. And I like that puzzle in Gonshan Clever, but I like the feeling and the experience of it so much more in Russian Railroads.
Yeah. Man, this game, we played it of, what was it now, Jesse? Like 1.5 years or almost what, like a year ago or 2 years at this point,
I think it was
point,
like
right?
our third date.
Okay. Interesting phrasing. And
it's
timetable for that.
Valentine's Day, but that's fine.
And I remember being a little bit confused with what was going on. I've never really dealt with a multiple track game before, but since that time, I have experienced a lot of track games. And one of the things that I found fascinating about this one is that the tension is always there. Yeah. The decisions feel really crunchy, and it's just interesting throughout the entire experience, right? You're always trying to figure out something. And in terms of thematics, as you mentioned, Jesse, I feel that the way that you're trying to approach the building of this empire is the theme in itself, right? Trying to figure out and carve your way through all these actions to forge your own rail ahead and move across everyone.
It's not steeped
in that flexibility.
It's not steeped
exactly
in it, but it definitely is there. And to me, as someone that is a make or break element, it didn't lose it on me.
100%.
Johnny, I would have to agree with you, you know, and before I do like a top 10 worker placement or something, I feel like Jen and I should sit down and play through a bunch of our favorites so we can remember and rank them accordingly. But there is no way that this one's, when it comes to worker placement or Euro style games in themselves, there's no way this one's not in the top 10, and it's probably competitive for top 5. Mm-hmm. I really, really have enjoyed this one, and I'm excited for the expansion, or not the expansion, the update and reprinting. I think it's going to open the door for a lot of people. I think there's going to be some people that are disappointed because of the grail nature of it. And maybe it's too high on a pedestal. But for those of us that just know how to mediate expectations a little bit, not that this podcast is helping, and know what they're getting into, I think they'll find a game that stays on the shelf for a long time.
Definitely.
So for everybody listening, If you want us to cover this again, if you want us to bring in the big box edition of Russian Railroads, let us know in the comments. If you want to hear Johnny, well, you know what? You don't even have to say so. We're bringing Johnny Pack back. That was absolutely fascinating, Johnny. We need to get you in an interview chair ASAP. And I have one final very important question for you, Mr. Pack. Are you taking apprentices?
You know, it's funny. This is actually a funny question because I actually just had somebody last week ask me if I would give a game design lesson. They're like, can I hire you to give me like an hour long, you know, Skype lesson or whatever else on game design? And I've taught private music lessons and art classes and all that throughout my life. It never dawned on me to teach a one-on-one sort of thing because I think there's such a give and take nature of like the protospiel scene and all this other thing where it doesn't matter if, you know, I might be play testing Matt Leacock's game and it's just what you do. And it's like, he's happy to have somebody there. And it's like, I give feedback, which feels weird. It's like, I'm not worthy to these, some of these guys or Tom Lehman, some of these Bay Area guys. And it's amazing to be in their presence and realize, you know, you're a play tester playing their game and your feedback is sometimes useful to them. And, people play test my stuff too. And it's like, they may never have designed a game or maybe they're just starting, but they still might catch something in one of my games that I missed or would be better and have a really cool insight. For sure. They might be the next huge designer. I remember playtesting a couple of my games, which was later turned to Fistfill Meeples, one turned into Sarah West and this other. And there's this guy that showed up at the convention and he hadn't designed a game and he's just kind of wandered in and he's a really sweet dude. And he was really a great playtester. Like, wow, that guy's amazing. He showed up in a van and is just here. And that turns out to be Kevin Russ of Calico fame now. And so it's like, he just kind of showed up at DunderCon in California and we all warmed up to him as just this guy. And he just playtested other people's stuff. And then he went and grokked it. And suddenly he's just like this acclaimed designer and he's just on fire. And it's amazing. So, I don't know if wow. I even feel like really comfortable in the sense of like, there's like a teacher student sort of relationship. It would kind of be like, we're all in this together sort of a thing. So if I, you know, ever was going to be in a role like that with somebody, I think I'd rather see people as peers and that we're just trying to make cool stuff and they might have something really neat and maybe I'll have some insights that help it. Maybe I won't. And if there's a time and a place for it, it would be a lot of fun just to throw stuff on the table and push parts around and then talk shop for 2 hours afterwards.
Jesse, are you thinking the same thing that I am? We're not worthy. We're not worthy.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.